Welcome to Launch, where we explore the world of invention and entrepreneurship. I'm Jim DeBetta, here with my co-host Ron Reardon and our producer Lee Cantor. Good morning, guys.
Hello, Jim.
Welcome back, Ron. Ron was on a
hiatus.
He didn't just run down to Florida for some sun. He went to South America.
That's how he does things.
Yeah, I was down in Peru. I got to see Machu Picchu, and my heart was pounding out of my chest, and my head was dizzy, but I survived.
He's back.
So any good invention stories from Peru?
Absolutely zero.
Nothing? No clever ideas?
It's the confidentiality thing. I think he's just going to keep them to himself, and then he's going to unleash them here in the U.S. markets in the
How's
next couple
the
of months.
Peruvian patent system?
You know, I don't have a clue.
Do they have a patent system?
Yes, they do.
I just want to make sure. You know, it's.
In fact, I think they joined the patent cooperation treaty recently. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
See that? A new market for you guys.
Yeah, but we learn something every day.
But there are just thousands and thousands of tourists down there in Peru.
That's it? Yeah. Primarily, that's their big industry?
That is the really big. That and they're the largest producer of gold in the world.
Really? I would not have thought that.
Yeah.
I would have thought like places in like Africa, I always thought, right?
Where that's gold, where the gold comes something. From?
Or yeah. Diamonds. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, no. Peru has a lot of gold. Yeah.
So they're a wealthy country.
Yeah, pretty good.
Tourists and gold. Other than oil, I don't know what else.
Peru stays green by the green that is brought in by tourists.
Good. Nice. Good. All right. Well,
good travel tip.
Welcome back, Ron. We have another great guest today, a friend of mine, Joe McVoy, calling in all the way from Colorado. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
We're doing good, as you can hear. Joe, you know, you have quite an impressive resume. I know you, of course, from your very successful audio CD series, Walmart Secrets, which I've said to you and to hundreds of people over the course of time that being in this business as long as I've been, your course is absolutely the most informative course for not only how to sell Walmart, but just understanding the whole distribution process and selling to retailers in general that I've ever listened to. And you know, I've listened to every one of the, I think it's 18 CDs as part of that set. So, you know, very impressive there.
I appreciate that.
Well, Joe, I'm going to just tell everybody a little bit more about what you've done. Certainly, I know you've grown a handful of national companies. I know you've sold a couple of companies to major retailers. You've had your ups and downs like everybody in this business, and I know today that you have a number of websites. It says you have 19 websites. I know you had a bunch, but I didn't know you had 19. I can't even manage two, never mind 19. You've got your USA Quick Connect company, which is we'll get into after, Profitable Marketing Systems, marketingsystems.com. You know, you're doing all kinds of stuff here. So, Ron, I mean, you know Joe a bit here, too. We got lots of questions, so I'm going to let you lead them off here with Joe.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, in the past, you know, what all have you sold, and how did you do it?
Well, we started selling souvenirs and screen-printed products back 20 years ago, and I had found a guy who had a factory, a small factory, and we got together with some of my ideas and his production, and then we started in souvenirs made out of the prismatic material that sparkles, reflects light into rainbows kind of stuff, and that did so well in the souvenir area that it was a real pain to do souvenirs because you would make 200 decals in 7 colors of printing, and then you'd have to go get another order. So we started in the sticker business, and we were like the 200th company to notice. I was very quick on the uptake there. After 200 companies were in that business, I said, maybe we should try that.
Okay.
So we made the kid stickers out of this material that we were using for the souvenirs, this shiny metallic stuff. And that material and that look that gave, the kids liked better, so it sold better.
Joe, is that like that holographic stuff? I mean, if I remember.
It's a holographic diffraction grating. We also did true holograms as well. But the stuff that sold the best was the holographic material screen printed on top of.
Now, I don't think I have to tell people the math on when you sell stickers for literally cents. When you sell millions of dollars of stickers, obviously you're selling millions of stickers. So, I mean, is that what got you really situated with retailers like Walmart? In other words, did that get your success vehicle up and running? Was these actual stickers in the way you did?
It was actually the stickers. Yeah, the thing that people really don't know is how big some of these niche markets can be. We were the 200th company to come into that business, and we got up to number three behind the Hallmark and American Greetings. And the way we did it, we had a lot of designs. We had hundreds and hundreds of different SKUs. So the business is selling little pieces of artwork, stickers are little pieces of artwork, essentially. And you have all these different designs, and we would be selling a retail package, would retail at a dollar. We would sell it to the typical retailer for 50 cents, and we could make it for about a dime.
Okay. Joe, look, I think the thing that a lot of people want to know, look, I mean, stickers are, you know, the way you've done them may be a niche, but I've got kids. I mean, they've got more stickers. I mean, they're everywhere. And, you know, you may have had a unique product in that business, but getting into the mass merchants with something like that, there had to be something you did other than just saying, well, we've got these unique stickers when there's all these big players. What did you do to really get
right
in there?
Because you said there were 200 other people in the space.
Yeah, there were 200 companies making stickers. And we didn't start in the mass market.
Okay.
We didn't have the financial resources to do that. And we didn't have any case to build to talk to a buyer to give them the proof they should give us a test. We started in independent gift stores and Hallmark kind of stores. And the first few years, we sold to those kind of stores and got about 5,000 customers in the gift and stationery independent store area. And what made us do well is a couple things. One, our product sold through faster than anything else. That's obviously the absolute most important thing. If your product doesn't sell through to the consumer, you're dead. Our product, because it was shiny and sparkly, grabbed attention from 20 feet away. The other thing we did with the independent retailers is we set up a kids club. And we had five competitors who had kids clubs, and the retailers didn't like those because they viewed them as the manufacturer trying to go direct to the consumer using the retail stores as a way to do it. So we set up our club as a traffic building promotion for the retail store.
Yeah, but Joe, back then, when you're talking about the origins of this, the internet wasn't really around. So how did you build a kids club that where today you build a kids club on your website? And
right. What was your kids club? How did it work?
Oh, yeah, there was no internet back then. What our kids club was is we had a limited edition sticker of the month that was dated and everything. We had window posters for the stores. We had a point-of-sale display that showed the sticker. We had membership cards for the kids, and we had a newsletter that was distributed through the stores. All of this stuff was co-branded with the retail store. So it had our name on it, but it also had the store's name on it. It was run through the stores, and where our competitors might have had 20 or 30,000 kids in their club. In 9 months, we got 900,000 kids.
Because you partnered, in essence, with each store. You were providing extra value for them.
It's basically a win-win.
Well, what it turned out to be, because we had a hot product and this club was working so well, we had to allocate stores. We would only allow two stores in one mall or by zip code. So we had 900 sticker club stores. And the sticker club stores were required to carry 4-foot sections of our stuff.
Okay, well, let's go back a little bit. Before you got into the club stuff, you said, you were in 5,000 stores. Who did all this work? I mean, I have people calling me, you know, yeah, they can call on, you know, get into, you know, 50 stores, 100 stores. They could do it one or two people, but they spend, you know, every waking moment doing that. How many people were doing this, and how long did it take, and what kind of effort was involved in getting into that many stores, considering that, again, there was no internet or anything to speak of to spread things around quickly?
No. It took 2 years, and the way I did it, I didn't, when we started, I didn't know anything about the gift industry, gift and stationery. I didn't know anything about that because I'd been in promotional products. But I did notice that they had gift shows, you know, in the L.A. show, the Chicago show. They have all these gift shows and the gift marts. So we did get a few customers the hard way, you know, just doing it ourselves, contacting stores. And we found a guy who owned some stores out in Ohio. So he owned 6 Hallmark stores. And he had taken our product line in and was having good luck with it. And he also turned out he was a rep, an independent gift rep as well, as a store owner. So we worked with him, and this guy had been in the gift rep business for 25 years and knew everybody. So it took me a little bit of time to get him convinced to do it, but I basically got him as my VP of sales, and he signed up the reps in the other parts of the country.
Okay, so you
knew them all.
So you had an independent...
It took him a weekend to get on the phone and call his buddies in California or New England or wherever. And then everybody, his friends and their companies picked up our product line. And we had about 200 sales reps, you know, a couple months later.
All right. So that's the big thing. You had a ton of independent reps, because I was going to say it's...
And basically, you leveraged the 25-year contacts that this one person had.
That's right. Because we didn't know the business at all.
Yeah.
But he worked with us on, I mean, we had started out making stickers on rolls, and that's a real mess for retailers. That's how they were doing it back then. We moved into packages. And, you know, with the barcode on them and all. And one of the most important things we did is we made our packages fit on Hallmark fixtures.
Oh, so you conform to what they already had.
Yeah, and not only that, when we had our 4-foot sections in the Hallmark stores, we made actual physical fixturing, the metal fixturing that bolted into a Hallmark's fixturing, painted the same color, looked identical, and it bolted in and made a 4-foot section designed to hold our stuff.
Yeah, so from a Hallmark standpoint, it was just kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah. Now, most Hallmark stores are independently owned. The corporately owned ones didn't want anything to do with our stuff because it competed with theirs. But all the independently owned ones loved it.
Yeah, it's nothing like talking straight to the decision maker.
Well, you know, a lot of those independent stores, even franchised chains now, they usually give them a certain allotment, a certain percentage of leeway. So, yeah, you have to buy everything that corporate tells you to buy, but you have that 2% or 5% leeway, and usually they do that and leave that for localized stuff. So if you're here in Atlanta and somebody wants to put like a Georgia Tech or University of Georgia branded item in the store, they can do that because it's localized. But and that's probably, like you said, the way you were able to sneak in there.
Well, a couple of things. One, back then I don't think they were quite as picky about that, and they could do what they wanted. The main thing is that the word gets around when something sells well. The gift reps, the reps in general, can't sell worth a darn, but they're great at taking orders. So we were doing 3 or 4 million in sales. So we were running ads in the national gift industry magazines, showing the product and the merchandising and talking about the sell-through rate. So that what was starting to happen is the retailers, the owners of these little stores, would ask their rep if they carried this line. And as soon as that kind of stuff starts happening, your couple hundred reps can take a lot of orders. Expecting them to go out and sell in the normal sense of the word is, you know, you're kidding yourself. That doesn't happen very well. They're not good at selling, but they are good at order taking.
Hey, okay, well, again, I want to go backwards for, because I don't want anybody to miss what's really important for them to know. I mean, to start any business, Joe, I mean, some people do it on a shoestring budget. Some people have a lot of money, but... I mean, what big costs did you run into in the beginning, and how did you pay for whatever it is that was part of the process of getting going, whether it was advertising, marketing, just buying the stickers from the factories, packaging, you know, displays, you know, ads in all these magazines. How did you come up with the cash to do that?
I had about $10,000, and what I did, the guy I found who had a little screen printing operation, which was him, his wife, and two employees, so that's pretty little. I put in $10,000, with to be a partner with him, so we would be 50-50. Then what we did is we started making the products and selling them, and we built it up from there with its own cash flow.
Got it.
We did not import anything. We manufactured everything ourselves.
Oh. Organic growth, then.
Right. So we were doing the screen printing. The key to doing growing on your own cash flow is margin. When we can make something for a dime and sell it to a retailer for 50 cents, you know, you start selling $1 million worth of stuff at 50 cents when it costs you $100,000 to make. It's you build up your own cash flow that way.
Right. And
so we didn't have, we ended up using lines of credit with banks and asset-based financing when we were dealing with Target and Walmart because, you know, they were really big dollars. But at the beginning, we were able to do it with our own cash flow.
Yeah. And at the beginning, when you're sitting there looking at 200 companies in the industry and you're getting ready to go into that, that seems kind of formidable. Is how in the world are you going to succeed in such a crowded market? At the beginning, how did you know that your products were going to sell and that this would be profitable for you?
Well, you never know until you do tests. Of those 200 companies, there was only one other company using the prismatic material we used.
Okay.
We saw that that material, when turned into souvenirs, sold better than anything else. So I thought it would be worth a test to see if it would sell better than anything else as a sticker as well.
Okay.
So it turned out it did, and as we developed our product line, we had test stores. We had several hundred market test stores who, the deal with the store was we would call them on the phone, they would tell us how many of each design of sticker was still on the rack, and in exchange for that, we'd give them the stickers at half price.
Okay.
So we weren't trying to make money with the store. We were trying to get good market research on, we got 100 designs in that store, and that we're getting counts every couple days on how many sell of each one. So our product introduction system was to make small quantities of product, put it in the test stores, see what sells, and what sells is what we roll out to the customer base.
That's real smart.
All right.
So we didn't make many mistakes that way because the manufacturing system we had would allow us to make small quantities. We could make very small quantities of things profitably, so we were able to make a small quantity for the test stores, see what sells. Most things fail, but if we sold them to the test store at our cost and it failed, so what? So if you break even on your loss, on your mistakes, and you make lots of money on your successes, that's pretty good.
Because you know what not to do, what not to sell.
What?
You would know what not to sell.
Right.
And also you're protecting your relationships with all the stores. You're only giving them the winners.
That's right.
Hey, Joe. All right, let's jump ahead, okay? You've infiltrated, it seems like, every Hallmark and every other independent retailer that could sell these products, you know, in the United States. Now you want to go to the mass merchants. I mean, we all know that ultimately a lot of us want to be there. I know I always wanted to be there, and you obviously were there. So how did that start? Did you then decide to take all your stats to Walmart? Did Walmart find you? How did that first meeting go? What happened there? How did you get into the big time?
Okay, at the time, Kmart was the bigger player than Walmart. But it's sort of a funny story. Our printing facility was in northern Iowa, and Target's in Minneapolis. So the first time I went up there, I just got in my car and drove up to Target, thinking at that point that our product should be retailing the mass market version at a buck and a half, and that I would sell it to them for 75 cents. That didn't happen. I ended up going back up to Target like three times, and we finally did get an order for like 37 and a half cents instead of 75. But like I said, since we could make them for a dime, we were still okay. And the funny thing that started the whole thing is our first order from Target was a mistake. The buyer had meant to buy $5,000 worth of stickers, but they put another zero on it. So we got a $50,000 order. And, you know, they realized they made a mistake, and they called us to change it, and we said, sorry, it's already shipped. And what ends up happening is these stores now are going to get 10 times what they had a plan for in terms of space. So they sort of had to, like, spread it out. This was going direct to stores, not to a warehouse. And what happened then with this 10 times the quantity they had intended to buy is it still sold out right away.
Okay, so, all right. All right, you got to Target, you went up there a few times, but how did you get the appointment? Did you, I mean, obviously, again, without email or anything, which is how a lot of people do it today, how did you find the buyer and how did you get in there all knowing that, you know, the sticker business was pretty well covered at mass?
Well, because we already had this big success in the independent gift stores. We got a hold of the buyer and told him, yeah, we know you guys have lots of stickers, but we have the best-selling product line of stickers in the independent gift stores, and I think you'd probably like to take a look.
So you had marketing data.
In other words, the point was we had proof that our product sold through better than anything else, and that was enough to get us the appointment.
There's nothing like having hard marketing data.
Right.
Well, I mean,
and they could see, you know, we were starting to get into grocery stores. We were getting the kids club thing went crazy because the effect of the kids club was, say, a Hallmark store that had our club boosted their sales 20% for the entire year.
Yeah, but was Target interested in running a similar program, or was
Target
just interested in selling stickers?
They're just interested in selling
without
stickers.
The work.
But the point is, when you have something that you're having such demand for that you have to allocate it almost, meaning the kids club. But the reason the retailers like the kids club is it brought traffic into the stores. They sold more stuff. They made more money. And that makes a pretty good story to tell Target. They're going to do it differently. They're not going to sell stickers on rolls. They're going to sell them in packages with UPC codes on them.
You know, Joe, your story is definitely unique because when I started in this business with my own company, most buyers could care less about how I was selling at the independent level. They said, well, we're proud that you're selling your stuff to local sporting good chains and craft stores, but, you know, that doesn't translate into sales here at mass. And although you would think it's common sense that, hey, if thousands or tens of thousands of stores are selling a product successfully, that, well, those same people go shopping at big stores too.
Right.
But
they don't think that
they
way?
They didn't care. I mean, I had, you know, I don't know if it's, well, it's probably a combination of, you know, you had such enormous success. I think a lot of people go into these mass merchants and say, yeah, I'm selling 20 boutiques, and they're like, you know, whoop-de-doo.
Right. So, but what about the fact he was selling in thousands? I mean,
that could have been, and back then, you know, things change, and Joe was on to something with these stickers being so unique in the way they were packaged versus being on a roll. So all those things add up to having that unique and clear benefit.
Right.
And he had such momentum that the buyer at Target said, hey, look, let's test them out. Let's see. And then, of course, he gets that sell-through he's talking about. And all of a sudden, it's you know, he's running into the sunset, you know, with big
but
sales.
But can it be replicated? Is that system replicatable? What do you think?
Is what?
Is your system, can somebody take the path that you did to get to your success? Can they replicate that, or you just had a unique product?
Sure they can. Yes. The key criteria they have to have is they have to have a product that will sell through in the store and that will sell through, turn faster, and make better profit than what's there now.
You know, I think
our case, we had that, but most products that we see from other people, you know, they're going to, they don't have a clear difference from their competition. They don't have any proof that it will sell quicker. And why should the retail buyer take a risk in testing something that doesn't have isn't going to make a substantial improvement to their department's profit? The other thing that happens is we didn't have a single item. We had a product line. Now, Target just gave us a half a dozen pegs, but we could fill a 4-foot section. You have, especially these days, if you have a single item, you're going to have a really tough time getting it into a mass market store because it's a single SKU And Walmart just cut back 700 vendors.
Well, you know, Apple, I think, had some success with, you know, we call item-driven products. You know, Joe, it's so funny how people can be successful in so many different ways. When I started out, we didn't have product lines. We had singular items, and that got us in. I think it just depends on the category, you know, the actual product itself. You know, who knows? It's amazing how people succeed. I mean, on paper, your model is the best. You have a full line. You've got something revolutionary.
High margin.
Yeah, revolutionary, easy to pack, easy to ship. My stuff, you know, we're talking about binoculars and telescopes. This is, you know, more complicated stuff. But, you know, it's an expensive item. You know, you buy a $100 or $200 binocular that's really unique. You can go in with one SKU, and it's from a dollar perspective, it's worthwhile taking up space.
Yeah. And Joe, from an intellectual property standpoint, you know, patents, copyrights, trademarks, did you utilize any of those, or did you just decide to outsell your competitors?
No, well, we got copyrights. There was nothing patentable about it because we were just screen printing on a raw material that was already available.
Correct.
So there was no patent possibilities. We got copyrights. On each design, we did do that.
Yeah, I think a copyright's the appropriate thing for your particular product. Did you ever have any kind of competition?
Yeah, we had one company who knocked us off, which was pretty funny in a way because the cheapest way to manufacture a sticker is on a web press with all seven colors or nine colors all in line and the die cutting in line. So raw material goes in one end, finished stuff comes out the other. We didn't do it that way. We did sheet-fed screen printing, so we would run one big piece of material through the press, print it one time, and then we'd change the screen, and we'd do it a second time with the second color. So we'd run it through the press seven times and then twice more for die cutting. So that sounds insanely stupid to have a nine-step manufacturing process where other people have one step. The difference was when you're running them on a web press, the dies and plates are expensive, and you end up having to make 100,000 or a million of something to make the cost each make sense. We could make a dozen of something. So our competitor was using the same material we were, but using a different process, and it would cost them a couple thousand dollars to introduce a new design. You know, now they get teddy bear stickers. So that was $2,500 plus maybe $5,000 of inventory to create the teddy bear sticker. Well, we totally blew them away at one trade show because we showed up with 200 new designs, which for him would have been, you know, what, $1 million of cost? And for us, because of the method we used to make them, cost us about the same thing one design cost him. So we were able to proliferate designs, put them in those test stores, see what will sell. And we did have a uniqueness in how we made our stuff that made a tremendous difference.
Yeah, so your system was more labor and time intensive, but a whole lot more cost effective.
Ours is tremendously labor intensive. Well, we would run big sheets through, and there'd be lots of stickers on a sheet, but yeah.
Well, you know, I guess it's labor intensive too for the machines. You know, I always tell my wife when like she's doing laundry. Hopefully she won't listen to this. She'll get mad. I always say this to her anyway, but I'm like, she's like, oh, I just did five loads of laundry. I'm like, no, the machine did the laundry. And she always laughs. But it's one of those things where I guess without your printer friend, you know, Joe McVoy, couldn't have happened. I think, you know, we hear this a lot, Ron, where we have guests that they had a friend or somebody they knew that was, you know, in a position, whether they were a designer, an engineer, a printer, an attorney, a marketing expert, and they leveraged their collective skills to put something together. And that's what's brilliant here, Joe. It's that, you know,
I didn't know anything about this. The guy I ended up being partners with, I was running an injection molding plastic company that made Frisbees for the promotional products industry. I didn't know anything about stickers, anything about selling at a retail to gift market or mass market. I didn't know anything about any of that. The way my partner had this unique way of making things so we could make stuff really cheap in small quantities, and then we found people who did know, like the rep, who was one of our customers, who did know how the retail landscape worked for the gift industry, and then by the time we got to the mass market, we'd figured it out. Yeah. But an interesting thing is this company that made the stickers, we went from nothing. So our first year we did $100,000, and our fifth year we did like $13-14 million. Well, we were doing over $1 million a month, and when you think about stickers, that's like hundreds of millions of stickers.
It's a lot of stickers.
And yeah. And the business grew up like a shot, and then we ended up going out of business because we thought we were going to do $50 million the next year, and the sticker market took a nosedive for 6 months, and it knocked us out of business.
Yeah, nothing lasts forever. But I think the real tip for entrepreneurs is that you need to team up with people that either have the talent or the contacts that you don't have.
Right.
You got to be brave, too. I mean, there's no question that, you know, you can tell your story now, but I'm sure when you were going through this, there were a lot. I mean, I had a lot of tense moments. There were times when I said, "What in the world am I doing?" You know, I can go get a job. It's, you know, I punch in, punch out. I don't have to take my
and that ten home. Grand then.
Oh yeah, well, there were a bunch of times we paid payroll out of our personal accounts. That's the way of an entrepreneur, I guess. That's the way things work. It was interesting though, even way back then. The only retailer who had their act together was Target, because what happened in the sticker market was it was such a hot product for so many years that the retailers would buy assortments. And if you buy an assortment of thing of different designs and then you reorder the same assortment, the ones that sell, the ones that don't sit there, and now you've ordered the same mix again, so you bought more of the stuff that doesn't sell and it sits there. And pretty soon you have a display of stuff sitting there, and the retailer declares the market dead. In the case of Target, Target tracked each design. So though our sales to Kmart and other big retailers dropped through the floor, our sales to Target never even dropped. They kept going up because Target only reordered the things it sold. It sounds so obvious these days, but back then, having the computer systems to do that, Target was like a leader in that. So anyway, what happened after that company exploded is I went and started another one, which is what we serial entrepreneurs do. And at this point, I had noticed this raw material that it was expensive raw material, vinyl. We were competing with stickers made on paper. Well, prismatic vinyl is a lot more expensive than paper. And where Hallmark would sell a 4x6-inch sheet of stickers for a dollar, they would have four sheets in the package for a dollar. We would have one sheet of 3x4-inch. So we were, you know, one-tenth the amount of square inches. What happened, I saw in the marketplace, they were coming out with very thin-film vinyls or thin-film polyesters that were metallic and metallized and diffraction gratings put into them. And essentially what happened is the raw material got cheaper. And I said, okay, I'm going to start another company, and now I can make bigger things because the raw material doesn't cost as much. So I said, well, the kids like this sparkly stuff, so how about we do school supplies? And so we do two pocket folders, spiral notebooks, pens, pencils, rulers. There again, in a whole 4-foot section of school supplies made out of this holographic material, and I went back up to Target with that. And Target at this point is the same buyer, and the buyer really liked me because we had brought him great products, and he worked. I actually had the buyer helping me design the school supply line, and the only reason he did that is because we'd been selling them for 3 years and had a great track record. We developed this whole school line of holographic products, and in Target it went so well that we got a Best New Vendor Award for the stationery and school supply department. We were their best new vendor, and we got 4-foot end caps, which is, like everybody knows, the best place you can be is by a checkout or on an end cap. And so we got a whole end cap of our stuff, and once we had one season of that, we went to Walmart.
And you're really fortunate that the same buyer was there 3 years later, because I understand nowadays buyers kind of rotate in and out.
This is a senior buyer. It wasn't just the category guy. It was the department.
Okay.
Who knew?
And he was still there. Once we had tremendous sell-through in Target for the school supply line, then we took it to Walmart because when we went to Walmart before that, they weren't interested because we were selling a two-pocket folder for a retail of $2 where the competition was 69 cents.
That's really incredible.
You know, who
we were triple or, you know, three times the price of our competition, which if you sell the same number of units, it's a home run. But if you don't, you know, it's a problem. So the following year, Walmart did take us, and it sold out of there, too.
Okay.
So then we were off and running with a totally different company. And this new company, we did not manufacture any of it. In the sticker company, at our high point, we had 300 employees. In the school supply company, which did almost the same amount of dollar volume, we had 8. Because we outsourced everything within the U.S. because we couldn't get it made overseas efficiently.
Great lessons.
Who knew stickers could be so complex? I look at a sticker, I'm like, it's a sticker, you know. And meanwhile, people don't realize just how much
goes into it.
Hey, Joe, listen, we have a couple more minutes, and we want to make sure that we get from you where people can learn more about you on the internet and through your other businesses. So if you could be so kind as to tell us how people can find you.
Okay. My email is Joe McVoy, MCV as in Victor, OY, at gmail.com. The websites I have that are relevant to what we're talking about, WalmartSecrets.com. I have a free CD I give away there, and I also have the full course that Jim mentioned before that's 21 CDs. I also started another company because what I found is people who bought the course or got some of my information wanted us to do it for them or help them. So USA Quick Connect, that's USA Quick, Q-U-I-C-K, Connect.com, is the other business I set up with some other partners for the purpose of actually helping people get their products in the stores. The Walmart Secret is a do-it-yourself, here's what's involved type of information product, and the single CD will tell most people everything they need because a lot of people who are inventing products really don't understand that it's not about the product, it's about the gross profit per square foot you get the retailer.
Okay. Well, Joe, thank you so much for calling in. This has really been great, and we really appreciate your time and especially sharing your knowledge and your journey.
Glad to do it.
Okay. And this has been another exciting episode of Launch with special guest Joe McVoy and with Jim DeVetta and our producer Lee Cantor and Ron Reardon signing off.